We're going to be looking at the life of Moses, kind of like we did Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and following the story of Moses, and we begin with Moses tonight. We're going to read about the birth of Moses. Usually when I have a picture of Moses in my mind, it's not of a baby, it's of this old man with white flowing hair, and he's got a staff in his hand, and he's standing there like this, and the sea is parting behind him. You know, the Charlton Heston version. And I thought, a couple Sunday nights in March, when I probably, if I do have my knee surgery and I'm incapacitated, we're just going to watch the Ten Commandments for a couple of nights. I mean, that's kind of the classic thing. Not that you follow exactly everything biblically in that movie or any portrayal, but it is a portrayal of the story of the Exodus. And we're going to be moving towards studying and looking at the Exodus and how God is working in the life of his people, the Israelites, and about Moses and about the importance of the law and the Ten Commandments and all those things. But when I think of Moses, I usually think of an old man, but realize that much of his life, of course, he didn't lead the people out of Israel till he was 80 years old. When you think about that, two-thirds of his life was gone when he... You basically look at Moses' life in three sections, and they're about the same amount of time, 40 years, that he grew up in the palace of Egypt, the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And then for 40 years, he was in Midian and preparing for what God called him to do. And he was probably about 80 years old when he experienced the burning bush, and God called to him and told him to go back and to lead his people out. And then the last 40 years, he leads them out. And then, of course, they're in the wilderness for 40 years, never going into the promised land because of the unbelief and unfaithfulness. And Moses never does make it into the promised land. He sees from Mount Nebo into the land, but does not go in. And so Moses' life can be looked at in sections of 40 years. Last week, we read about the midwives and the important part of the story from chapter 1, where there was so much tension between the Israelites and the Egyptians, and the Egyptians began to oppress this minority people, this foreign people, the Hebrews, and the tensions grew greater, and the resources were smaller, and the building projects continued. And so the Israelites, over the course of about 250 years, went from being this group that was so cherished and loved because of Joseph and how he saved Egypt from famine, and he was forgotten, and that story was forgotten, and the descendants of Jacob began to be disliked at first, and then they were feared by the Egyptian people, and then they were treated very harshly. The scripture from last week told us they were treated harshly and bitterly, and it just became worse and worse, and will become worse and worse over the next couple of chapters as we look at that story. Well, the Hebrew midwives, we know two of their names, Shipra and Puah, one meaning beautiful and one meaning pleasant, and how they feared God. The text tells us specifically that they feared God and they defied the instructions of Pharaoh and they let the baby boys live, even though when Pharaoh said, when the babies are born, if they're boys, they're to be killed. If they're girls, they're to let live. But the animosity had grown so much between the Israelites and the Egyptians that they even were killing the baby boys. And so that animosity has continued. And then Pharaoh ordered the death of all Hebrew infant boys. We finished last Sunday night with that text and that verse, the last verse of chapter 1, verse 22. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people, every boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. I mean, it was outright, it was direct. There was this tension, this hostility that was being put upon the Hebrew people. And now we fast forward to chapter 2. I don't know how much time is between verse 22 right here in chapter 2 in Exodus. Obviously, there was time that was moving by. There was this animosity. I don't know that there were a lot of baby boys that were killed during this time. We really don't know. I mean, the context sure tells us that it's possible, but we know that it was a time of great tension and anger and hostility. And so now we fast forward to the story in chapter 2. And so Tonight I want to read the first 10 verses of Exodus chapter 2 and read of the story of how God intervenes once again at a time as the people began to cry out. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. Her sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the river bank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered, and the girl went up and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." The first thing I notice in the first two chapters of the book of Exodus, and just kind of mention, not that it's a direct part of the story, but it's certainly something that I see as I've been reading through the book of Exodus, is the impact in the first two chapters of the women on the story, the leadership of the women, and the influence of the women. I mean, it's kind of obvious as we look that the two midwives, two of the midwives are named, Shiphrah and Puah. You think, wow, midwives. In the Old Testament, there's not a lot of women named, but here, these two midwives were seen as people of great faith. They did what was right. They defied Pharaoh. They disobeyed what the king had said, and they're named here. And then you have Moses' mother, whose decisions and fun and interesting part of the story are found. And you have Moses' sister, older sister Miriam, who takes place in this story and following the baby as he floats in the papyrus basket down the river. And then you have Pharaoh's daughter. All of them, we give them credit. All of them are a part of the story that we find here. Well, the parents of Moses' names are not given in chapter 2. Their names are not mentioned here, but later in Exodus chapter 6, we learn about Moses' parents. Moses' parents' names are given. The genealogy of Moses' life is important, and it's documented in the book of Exodus. Moses was not just one of 100,000 babies born in a 50-year stretch in Egypt. But the genealogy of Moses goes back to the calling of God on Abraham. The genealogy is important. The names of Moses' parents were Amram and Jochebed. I guess I did ask last week who knew that, and Alice came up with it, and the spokesman got it right. Amram and Jochebed. They were both descendants of Levi. Chapter 2, verse 1 tells us that. There was a man of the house of Levi, and he married a Levite woman. That seems to be an important detail, that whoever were the parents of this baby who would be used by God were descendants of Levi. They were descendants of Levi. I don't ever remember hearing really too much about the house of Levi until later in Old Testament history, but it is right here in the beginning of the book of Exodus. God had chosen one of the sons of Jacob to be the house that would lead to the priesthood for the Israelite people through the history of the Old Testament. Now, why God chose Levi, I'm really not sure. He didn't seem to have that great a character to me. In fact, he would probably be second or third in the list of those that did acts that were not very godly and wholesome. But whatever the case, God chose and allowed that the descendants of Levi would fulfill a certain role in the history of the Israelites. The lineage of Moses was important. It's important, it's mentioned in chapter 2, but it's also important as you read on in the book of Exodus. And the lineage, of course, goes back to Levi. And the lineage is detailed in Exodus chapter 6. This might be a time, if you want to read along, to turn to chapter 6. You don't have to, but if you're interested in that, because I'm going to read some things from chapter 6, and it's going to show us about the lineage of Moses. This is a partial genealogy. The genealogy in chapter 6 kind of begins at about verse 14, and it lists many names, and most of them are connected to who Levi is. Now, actually, the first three sons of Jacob are mentioned. The first three sons of Jacob, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, the first three sons. And so the sons of Reuben are named, the sons of Simeon are named, and then the sons of Levi are named. And then from there, the rest of the genealogy is about the descendants of Levi. It's Levi's line that is detailed and extensive. For Reuben and Simeon, simply they're mentioned, their sons are mentioned, and that's the end of it. But for Levi, his sons are mentioned, his grandsons are mentioned, his great-grandsons are mentioned. Now, when you look at a genealogy like this, you might think, okay, it's going to include every person of the family. But that's not really the case. It's not often the case in genealogies, as you know, and it's not often the case in biblical genealogies that all the descendants of someone are named. But some of them, or a certain line of them, are mentioned. It doesn't mean that there are not more descendants of Levi, because there were many more. But the ones that lead to the birth of Moses are defined and shown in this part of the of Exodus chapter 6. Well, of course, this book, the book of Exodus, we talked about last week, was penned by Moses. Later on, long after the events took place in the book of Genesis. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the first five books of the Bible are books of history. And they're attributed to Moses. Either Moses, later in his life, or someone connected to Moses, his servants, wrote down the first five books of the Bible. And so it was important to Moses to get it right, to get the genealogy right. It was planned and written by Moses. And so Moses would have also known his own genealogy, for that matter. Okay, well, what do we see about this from chapter 6? Number one, that Moses was a direct descendant of Levi. We also know that Levi has three sons that are named here. Three sons that are named. Kobath was one of them. The three sons of Levi, according to the records, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Okay, so Levi has three sons, and then we're told that Kobath is the father of Amram, and then Amram becomes the father of Moses. So if you get to this man named Amram, he's the grandson of Levi, and so that means that he's the great-grandson of Jacob. And so you look at Amram, and you go back to eight generations. Moses would have been born the eighth generation from Abraham, and a direct descendant of Abraham, from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Levi, Kobath, Amram, and then Moses. So seven or eight generations, depending how you count them. And so that was important. Moses was a direct descendant of Abraham, and his genealogy is shown here. Obviously, all of the Israelites were descendants of Abraham. It's not that the others were not too, but it's important enough to show the genealogy that it's listed out in this way. Moses was not just one of a million babies born of in Egypt, but he's a direct descendant. And the stories have been passed down through generation to generation and generation. Obviously, this is a day before books were written. There were things recorded, of course. But before you had the volume of writings, and so you have the stories that are passed on from Abraham to Isaac, and how God had called him, and how God had made the promises. And Isaac told his son Jacob, and Jacob told his 12 sons. And those stories are passed down. And then in the eighth generation, then they're all written down, and they become the first five books of the Bible. Okay, so Moses was a descendant of Levi, and he was born during this time of great bitterness and animosity, all the way to the point that Pharaoh is threatening the lives of every Hebrew boy born. Well, verse 2 says, when she saw that she had a fine child, verse 2 says, when the mother of Moses sees that Moses is a fine child. I don't know what she means by a fine child. When she saw that he was a fine child, I know all my grandkids are fine children. You know, I've never seen a baby that's not. But Moses maybe remembered back to how fine he was. I don't know. Or, you know, he had people say, boy, you are a good-looking baby. You know, I don't know. But it says that when his mom noticed what a fine child he was, she hid him for 3 months. She didn't want the cries to go out. She didn't want the Egyptians to hear. I wonder if mothers at that time kind of hid their pregnancies and hoped that the authorities would not find out about it. But she, like any mother, desperately wants to save the life of her child. However she can do that. The fact that she hid him for 3 months and then what she does after that tells us that there was a real threat and there probably were babies that were killed, although we don't know that. We are not told that. But it would seem from her actions that it was a very real possibility that her son would be taken and put to death. So Jochebed, the mother, the nurturing mother, comes up with a plan. She prepares a basket, a papyrus basket, and covers it with pitch. And of course, what does that remind us of from earlier in the book of Genesis, the ark, and how it was covered with pitch? And just a reminder, it was a basket, it was a place of safety, it was an ark of safety. And so you have the ark in Genesis, and then you have a basket in Exodus reminding us of God's ability to save in the midst of horrible circumstances. Well, Jochebed comes up with a plan, and plying on the instincts and nurturing nature, she sets up a plan. It would seem like she absolutely knew what she was doing. I mean, it would seem like she was calculating about this. At least that's the way I see it. She had to be in apparently eyesight of the palace, or she knew that if she put the baby in a certain place, that it would float down to the palace. She must have known where the Pharaoh's daughter bathed, and probably it was a well-known place where people came and bathed, and they had their patterns and those things, and it would seem, I just can't imagine this is a random act. She just puts the baby on the water and says, okay, somebody protect my baby boy, but instead she likely knows which way the current's going. She knows that if she puts the baby in among the bulrushes, that somebody is going to see it. And the person that's going to see it is somebody from the palace. My guess is that she knew something even perhaps about Pharaoh's daughter. I mean, it well be that there's so much more to this story than we know completely. She could have known about Pharaoh's daughter and about who she was and how she felt. She may have known about how people perceive this law and this edict from the king that the babies be put to death. And so she puts her son into the basket to go down the river. Can you imagine how scary that would be for a mom to just trust that? And you know, of course, when I think of the Nile River, I think of crocodiles. And I don't know how safe it would have been down there. Maybe they weren't in this area and this place. But it makes me think that maybe Pharaoh's daughter had a reputation. Maybe there was something about Pharaoh's daughter that the mother, Jochebed, already knew about. Or maybe it's even possible that Jochebed knew some of the handmaidens of Pharaoh's daughter and knew what they were like and maybe how they might react. Maybe playing on that sense of nurturing and that love of babies and whatever she's calculating, and she puts her plan into motion, into a papyrus basket and placed in the bulrushes and with an eyesight of the palace where maybe many of the women went to bathe often. Miriam, the older sister, watched from a distance. I think this detail is pretty interesting. Miriam stood at a distance. Again, this is part of the calculation. It's part of the plan as Jochebed is planning somehow to save the life of this baby boy. And boy, I would say how helpful Miriam was. I mean, Miriam just happened to be in the right place at the right time, and so everything went so perfectly. Playing on those maternal instincts, I just imagine Miriam, when she comes down and the maidens find the basket, and Pharaoh's daughter sees from a distance, "What's in the basket?" And they open it up, and there's a beautiful baby boy, surprise, surprise, there's Miriam. "Well, I think I can help you with this, you know. I just think that maybe I can be of assistance to you." And even the way when you read it, it just sounds. "Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the river bank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him." "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. One of the Hebrew. Almost as if she knew that it had to be an Hebrew baby. Maybe because of where they found it. Maybe because what it looked like. I don't know. Maybe because she knew Pharaoh's daughter did of what was going on. Maybe she knew of the grief of the women and the mothers that lived in that area. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities for that. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Pharaoh's daughter knows. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" That's why I think Miriam, boy, she just, you know, I happen to be right here and I can help you. Surprise, surprise. This is one of the Hebrew babies. Can I help you? And she was so helpful. I mean, she is about as helpful as you can have. Then appears Miriam. "I really think I can help you. I think that this can be good. I will go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you." Boy, talking about the, well, what's the right word? The guile of a woman? Is that the right word, Alice? The planning of a woman, the machinations that go on in bringing about.
Devious.
Devious, is that it? Okay. I was looking for help for somebody. So Miriam is a great actress. You know, I happen to be here. Can I help you? I can help you. I bet I could find a Hebrew woman to help take care of your baby. I mean, they knew apparently that Moses could not stay there in their home. They knew. I mean, this just shows you that they really believed that Moses would be killed. It's not just a possibility, but even to the point that Miriam said, "This is your baby. Take her. Take him. It's your baby, but we'll help you. We'll make sure that he has what he needs, because we love babies too." And of course, Pharaoh's daughter and whoever she was, her love of babies or her sense of goodness, or maybe she would have been like Pua or Shapura, who would have not allowed a baby to be killed. And so Miriam brings this proposal. "How about I'll go find a Hebrew woman?" Not knowing, did Pharaoh's daughter, that Miriam was the very sister of this baby in the basket. "Yes, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." Wow. Boy, I missed the turn of events. So now, Pharaoh's daughter offers to pay Moses' mother to raise him and to take care of him for a time, but it will only be for a time and be a time of nursing, a time of taking care of this baby. But it's also a time, however long it is, I'm not sure how long it is, that during this time Moses learned who he was. He learned about the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. So I don't know how young he was when he went into the palace. We know that he went there at a time. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. We think about this whole story and how twisted the plot is. I mean, just the miracle of the story and the wonder of the story, how God could orchestrate all these events so this baby, who is 3 months old, God sees all the way into the future that this is the one that he can use to bring the people out of Egypt. That is a God who knows the future. That is a God who understands time. That is a God who also holds our lives in his hands. And when I think of the detail of this story, I'm reminded that God does know our lives. I mean, ours may not be recorded in a great book, but your life is recorded in the book of God. Your life is recorded, the past, the present, and the future, in the book of God. So if tonight you might be wondering, Well, what purpose does my life have? Or how can God use me? The truth is, God has a plan for your life. Think especially of some young people here. If you're in that category, that's okay, however old you are. But God has a plan for you. He knows your future. It's like he knew this little baby boy. God knows what he has for you. And so you look for that, and you listen for that. You listen for what God wants to say and do for you. So the next 40 years, Moses is living in two worlds. He's called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, although later on he will back away from that and say, I am not going to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He's going to go back to who and where he was born and God's call on his life. Sometime as the mother, Jochebed, took that baby back in and continued to nurse him and teach him and train him, Moses learned who he was. He learned what it meant to be a descendant of Abraham. He learned who his people were. And then when he went to the palace, then he learned all about Pharaoh, and he learned all about Egyptian history, and he learned all about mastery and all the things. In some ways, Moses got two sides, and God allowed that to happen. I mean, how could God bring that about? That Moses would be the one that then later, 80 years later or so, would come back into the palace, confront Pharaoh, and say the things that he said to Pharaoh, and have the authority, and have the background, have the knowledge, in order to say the things that God told him to say to Pharaoh. It all began, I believe, at the teaching of Jochebed's niece. And in the story, as God allows the saving of this precious baby, the birth of Moses. Next Sunday night, we have our hymn sing and ice cream social at the New Hope Church. And so if you're able to join us there, we won't have a service here next Sunday night, but we'll go there as part of that. And then, Lord willing, the following Sunday night, we'll be back here and continue in this story of Moses' life and how God will use him in a great and a mighty way. I am grateful that you're here, and I'm glad that you sat up front, although I can live with it if you sit in the back, but I just like it when you're up front. I feel like we're together more. We're more connected, and I like to be connected. Hope you all have a great week. I hope I don't hear anybody else get sick that's not already. And we'll see you again soon. God bless each one of you. Thanks for being here tonight.